All right, this afternoon has a great atmosphere. These voices, then the sounds of boats passing by on the river, texts from a whole wealth of languages. I think we will be remembering this very special atmosphere for a long time to come. So let's continue our conversation. Before we do that, I would like to welcome as my next conversation partners the press director of Luchterhand Editors, Carsten Rösel, because it's Luchterhand Publishing House where this novel was first published. Okay, let's get started. Well, in the excerpts we just heard, we've just had a little impression from the story, but we will understand it better if we start in the beginning, which is what I would like to do. The novel, A Storm Blew In From Paradise, narrates the story of a young man from Uganda who, towards the end of the 1960s, beginning of the 1970s, is in Greece, where he trains to become a military pilot, just when a dictator comes to power in his country. This young man, always referred to as P in the novel, refuses to go back to his country and sees how his young comrades are attracted into the situation of dictatorship in the way back, and he turns to Greece and wants to go back to Africa eventually. He's been offered a job to fumigate areas from there. Then he is intercepted in Tanzania and interrogated. And that's where the book starts, with the forced report on his life. In that endeavor, the main character called P is presented with photos over and over. Johannes and Euro, when we asked him to take us to the cosmos of the creation of this book, we asked him to bring photos. So what photos are these? Well, what can I tell you about these photos? Well, these are very different pictures. My dad had in his suitcase when he was in his apartment. At times he would simply place them on the table and show them to us. These are pictures showing us his whole lifetime, basically. For example, times in Nairobi. And over here, for example, we can see this is a photo taken in Greece. This is when my dad was with the Air Force there, and he was the largest of the pilots, doing pole vault in a sports contest, which he was very good at. And you can see that he's got these white trousers on, these baggy trousers. Looks really special, doesn't it? And here's another photo where we can see, and these are the wings. So the wings were conferred to you when you had passed your training to become a military pilot. So he would take these attributes and symbols with him through his whole lifetime. And they were important to him, and they became more and more important. Also to me, when I was writing the book, they became more important to me, and it was precisely around these photos that a lot of things circled in my novel. Many of the photos show the destruction he saw. And already when he was with the Air Force, he needed to destroy the photos physically, because these were pieces of evidence he just simply didn't want to take with him. They could have been dangerous to him because he was a refugee in Kenya and in Tanzania. So these pictures is what remained what's left. So he always had the sorrow, this grief that he carried with him. He had evidence in these photos showing that his former life had really been true, that it had really happened, that he had been to Greece, that he had worked at the Air Force. This was the evidence. So it's this moment of evidence. We should put it into a perspective, a different way. There's one sentence in the novel where it says, really, he was too tall to serve on a modern military jet. He had done pole vault. He was really tall. So this little detail already tells us how your father, who dreamt of flying, turned into being an object of history himself. Yes, sure. When he was a little boy, that was the moment when his big brother, John, appeared. When he came back from World War II, he had fought in Burma for the British Empire. So he reported from the planes, and he called his little brother Wing Commander. So this sort of stuck to this boy's memory, photos of fighter jets, of combat jets, and he would play with these photos, with these memories. It's a long story. We can read more and learn more about how he turned to being a pilot, a fighter pilot. He was sent to Greece by the Ugandan government. I don't know how many years he spent there. In any case, it was a couple of years of training he spent there. And then he was called to an office and he was told, you're too tall. You can't even sit in a fighter jet, so you're too tall and your legs would be cut off. So he was offered to become a helicopter pilot or to become a transport jet pilot. But he wanted to become a fighter pilot, and he was trained to do that. That's what he'd been trained for. So he thought, this is the only thing that's worthwhile in my life, because helicopter pilots were looked down upon. Everybody else would tell them, that's not real flying, that's too soft, you're the softies, you're not real men, you're not real pilots. So it was his dream. Even after the coup d'etat, when he was an African refugee, when he was a refugee in Africa, he had this dream of being a pilot in a fighter jet. It was many years later that he came to Sweden. So he had this enormous longing, even expressed in his voice. And you could hear him still being on the horizon. Even when he would lie in bed at nighttime, you would still sense this feeling in a very vivid way. He would be describing that to us as children. And I wanted to capture that in my book. It was so important to him. The technical details didn't matter to me when he would speak about flying. But to him, it was important. I needed to be correct in my book. So the observation of the clouds and of the cloud formation is so important to pilots, and to recognize that, well, that's really interesting. You just said that these images were important to your dad. So this was also an expression of the fact that he did fulfill his dream of a lifetime. He did serve as a pilot. And you've brought us this book from Greece, this book he was carrying with him. And you said that the photos had been important to you in the process of writing the book. However, in the context of the novel, they have a different meaning. When P is being interrogated after coming back to Africa, to Tanzania, he is presented with photos as a supposed evidence to the fact that he was sent by the Uganda government, by the imperialists, to Greece and returned to Africa in order to serve as a spy. And that's where a very interesting statement appears in the book. the interrogator says with photos, it makes me think of the day of the Last Judgment. And this is a quote as well, a very famous quote. Why are you giving this quote to the figure of your father in a book? Well, as Agamben writes about these photographs, we learn, well, this is something I wouldn't really want to quote in this context. It doesn't lead us anywhere. But Agamben writes that photographs refers to the day of the Last Judgment because photographs preserve a moment for eternity. A human being is being preserved forever and memorized in the very moment of this human being doing something. For example, he's standing here on the beach in the dunes. He shows us how much taller he is compared to the Greek comrade, and also in the pole vault contest. When these photos were taken, nobody knew what importance and what significance they would acquire later. Later on, it is clear that this is a lost dream. So my dad would be looking back to this lost moment. And it is really like on the day of the Last Judgment. He has been judged upon. And in Greece, he's living a life in the shadows. This is something I wanted to look at with this Agamben quote. Photos are so full of hope. At the same time, they're full of judgment. At the same time.
And you can see pictures of yourself, and the face that you see calls something beyond time. It calls something that is called redemption. And that is a word in Swedish. They call justice, tell my story, remember me. That's what the pictures are calling. Even an anonymous picture that you would find on the street calls out to you and calls out these words. And I think the face in the photographs calls it, because every face and every photograph has a story that needs to be told. In the end of the book, my father dies and is lying there, and he is being washed. And for us Muslims, this is a very important ritual. The family members do it. And they also use perfumed stones. If you look into his face, it was not the face anymore that I used to know. It was like an object. The face of a dead person is like an object that has his story and his narrative. And it has something to do with the time of the story that you want to look at. And, well, why do I have the interrogator say this? Well, I thought it would be interesting and that it would be a bit eerie for the reader that somebody is sitting there who can say such a thing. Well, your lecture and the explications about your novel and also the philosophical cultural background shows how rich this book is. But you became aware of Johannes Aleu earlier on, and you translated his poems. That's right. When his first poetry booklet appeared, it was an instant success. And at the time, I thought that it was a new voice in Swedish poetry, because it had a direct voice. in poetry, you can be very experimental and write very abstract texts. But this is a text that describes people's lives very concretely, but at the same time quite rhythmically and violently. And my son was only 12 years old then, and he was going through a hip-hop phase. And I found also rhythmical access to the text. Of course, I know that he has also been active on that scene. And when I was asked to assemble an anthology of this text and other texts, I thought he would absolutely have to be represented in there. And since then, I read everything. The first books were poetry, and then a kind of transition to literature. And when I read A Storm Blew In From Paradise, I had the impression it was a novel that only a poet could write. And what attracted me on the language level is the mixture of a very factual tone that contains again and again poetic images. And the whole book has a rhythmical quality that also reflects poetry within the literature. Well, you said linguistic qualities. Marco Martin, you have written about South Africa, about other theaters, and also a novel called Sleeping Dogs. What made you aware of this book? Lots of things. I think we would spend the whole evening talking about all the things that fascinated me in this book. The whole jury was enthusiastic. And what I found particularly fascinating is the access to a biography that really, and I really have to underline this, is quite different from creative writing routine that spoiled middle-class kids write about their mother or their father or whatever, and that are entirely egocentric. This is radically different, and it is an actual genuine biography with ambivalence, ambiguity, and quite heterogeneous. That's what I found fascinating. And it's also something different from what is called post-colonial writing in academic categories. It is a feasibility in a mirror saying that the white people in Africa treat the black population as objects, and biographies are being collectivized. And here, this biography is individualized, and the power structure and the structure of power abuse are being shown here. Of course, this is something that did not end with colonialism. And after the fall of Idi Amin, this is something that was also seen in this manner here in Europe. Obote was just as bad, but people did not realize that here. There are things that people realize only in fragments. They don't realize how things went down in Uganda. And those fine details were not known here. This book is not a documentary, but it goes really deep into the individual topic. And what I just tried to describe is something that really fascinated me profoundly and gave me the feeling that it inscribes within a worldwide literary transition. There are pilot novels by Exupéry and André Malraux, his memoirs of a pilot. And this is somebody here who makes his dream come true and yet he becomes the object of powers that push him around. And the way this is being described here is great literature. And the experience in the camp, David Rousset wrote a novel in 47, and he said the 20th century is the century of camps, not only of the destruction camps, but also refugee camps and penitentiary. And this is an experience that goes on and on here. And these violences done to people are accompanying him for the rest of his life and did not leave him even when he was safe in Sweden. This complex and wonderful. Johannes, about the construction of the novel. There is one version where this novel is like structured in letters that the author writes to his younger stepsister. Why did you not use this version? Well, this is a picture of Miriam, the sister. I think you can see it. When you write a novel, you are searching for details. And my half-sister was my father's daughter. And we did not have any contact. Earlier, we had even worse contact when I was 16 or 17 years old. I talked about her with my father, and he said, yeah, you have siblings in Stockholm. And I said, right? I did not know that. And then we met from time to time, and once I met her when I was working on the book, and I asked her, how much did you know about Dad? Because I was the sibling who knew most about our father. The other brothers did not even ask any questions. So I asked her, how much do you know? But she knew next to nothing. And then we were sitting there in Stockholm and one day in a park, and I told her about the book. I narrated Dad's life to her. And after this meeting, I thought, that's what the book should be like letters addressed to her. And then also prolonging it, letters to my brothers who did not know details about my father's life. And I wrote a version where Miriam is quite present, because I always address my writings to her. He was there before us. Where did he come from? And why was he always absent? An absentee figure in our life. And that's also the explanation, because he was crazy. Well, he had a crazy streak. And maybe all refugees, all fathers have a kind of craziness that's something that feeds itself. And I also wanted to tell our brothers, where did Dad come from? And I wanted them to feel a certain sympathy for his destiny. I am the only one of all the siblings who managed to forgive him for never being there in our lives. He was not a bad father per se, but he was never there. He was always absent after the divorce between mom and dad. and my brothers and my sister had, they were very angry with him, and they were estranged from him. And I wanted to write all those things in the book in order to create a certain compassion for him. That was a trace that did not disappear because of theories or because the editor thought, no, this is never going to work. That's not the way it was. And Paul said that I am also a poet. And my editor doesn't always like that so much. That did not disappear. This trace of it remains in the book. And I wanted that the readers would cry reading about my father's destiny. It's a book that is supposed to create compassion and sadness, and that is supposed to do his fate justice. That's the way it was.
But it is absolutely evident that if you had chosen this narrational perspective, that in that case, you would have been tied to a timeline. The way the book is constructed now, your father's memories become present, which is an expression of the fact that they've haunted him all his lifetime. They've marked him. So the son is confronted with these memories, and that way you might have opted for the stronger construction. You were just speaking about the traces. In the course of this afternoon, we have also asked all translators to provide us with some traces of evidence of their translation work. And we've asked Mr. Burf to bring some pieces of evidence also from his work. And he said there are none. And we were wondering how it's possible. How is it possible, Paul? Well, I know I'm not like most of my colleagues. I think everybody needs to know this for themselves. I don't really work with a lot of materials. I do accompany my own work with nothing really, not with certain readings. I just work on my monitor. I do not print out anything. I do not put together any collection on paper-based materials. There might be one sheet of paper with a couple of terms on them. At times, I would jot down a couple of names or a couple of names of indigenous tribes in Africa, maybe. And then there would be letters. I'd write to Johannes. And that email conversation isn't preserved either. So that's my way of working. I prefer to concentrate sitting on my desktop or at my desk. Many of my colleagues love to read in a printed out version. I love to read on a screen, and I have my intermediary steps, which I do not preserve either. To me, it's very important to see my work on the screen, and it's important for me that this will be the only version left. I don't want to look back at the second and the third version, but once I move on with my translation, with my text, I only want to work with the last version there is. Well, generations of literary researchers will be unable to look back at the documentation of the work of translators of many big authors, like the ones you've translated. Well, but let me say one thing on this novel. You start reading the novel, and you start reading it as the father's story. And you get fully immersed into this story. And then at some point, all of a sudden, there comes this turning point. And the narrator comes and forms part in, of the story, and you're confused in the first moment. There is this moment in which you say, I want to know how this story goes on, the father's story. But then from that, the whole dynamics starts to emerge, specifically from this double perspective, being the father's story and the next generation story also, because that too is a very important point, the generation of sons and daughters still carries this heavy burden in their personal lives. The daily racism they're exposed to in Sweden, it doesn't just hit the father, but it also hits the son, and probably also the next generation following after. Maybe in a weaker form, but it still does. I would like to come to one source, speak about one aspect of the book. You said that you wanted to trigger compassion with your dad's fate. So you want a biography to be told, and maybe there's empathy, there's understanding, there's a sharing of feelings. You want people to feel that if it had happened to them, they too would have left the country. We always need to be aware of this fact. For, with every person coming to Germany, we need to be aware of the fact that we probably would have done the very same thing. So there's a level of compassion, but there's also a level of horror. It starts with the situation of interrogation. The father is addressed with the same sentence over and over. Why did you come to Africa? It is repeated over and over, and it seems to be evoking higher powers. But for the evocation of higher powers, we've got the literary category of horror. And there's a story by H.P. Lovecraft, The Shadow of Times, which probably had a very special influence on this book's writing process. Well, this takes us to different spheres, maybe unexpectedly. This is one of the traces to be followed in my novel. My publisher said, you have to take this out. This has to go. But it was one of my traces, one of the routes I followed. I was reading H.P. Lovecraft's novel, The Shadow Out of Time, in parallel to me writing the book. So this novel is a comic version of the novel. There's a novel available, and this is the comic version, the graphic novel. H.P. Lovecraft wrote horror novels, gothic novels, very modern stories at the time. A sense of horror not based on a monster, unlike Dracula. Not the evil, but based on the indifference of beings, the complete indifference. This has to do with Nietzsche. It has to do with a sense of horror that Nietzsche describes in his work. And that's the shadow out of time. So the author speaks about human beings living like monsters who've lived this way for millions of years, who used to live millions of years back, and these monsters are still alive, according to the novel. And to cut it short, these are monsters influencing our daily lives to this very day. Let me comment. I think this is fascinating. This is really like a palimpsest of literature. I couldn't have imagined that that would have influenced the novel. I had this image of Koester's book, Sonnenfinsternis, who asked the revolutionary, what have you done? And the past is given a new meaning after the solar eclipse described there. So I think this is fascinating. How much is possible in the act of commemoration and in writing, and what a wealth of different emotions can be evoked through the reading experience. This is another very interesting aspect of the book, definitely. And the link with this novel becomes even clearer as we sketch out the story of the Shadow Out of Time. It starts with a professor collapsing during a class he's giving, and as he wakes up, he's terribly changed. His wife asks for a divorce. He is not allowed to raise his own children anymore, and it triggers a whole chain of events. And all of a sudden, he comes back to the very moment in which he's lost conscience. All that has happened, but it seems that no time has passed. So after hearing what you just said, and after hearing how the experiences, these monstrous experiences in people's daily lives can be present, this is a very, very excellent mirror of the events described in your novel. Well, I try to incorporate that in the novel as an image for two things, basically, two aspects of the story. First of all, the narration itself of inhuman monsters influencing their times, taking powers to our very present from the past. That was my father's story. So much of what happened to him seemed inhuman. For example, he had this bump on his neck, and he had no conscience of where this bump had come from. He had undergone surgery with himself, so to say, in order to take this bump off, to undo this bruise. So that's the madness he carried in him. He was a very, very soft and gentle man at the same time. There was this madness, this craze in him. At the same time, he'd be so gentle and soft. So this was really an image of these opposing poles in him. And it's all about telling a story. For example, for my little sister, I wanted to tell her about my father, totally harmless, not dangerous. This is what you would tell your little sister. That's what he was like. Not telling the story in a sentimental way, but in a way which is told to raise shared feelings, compassion, which is meant to make us understand another human being. And at the same time, maybe what we do is awaken the monster from the past, bring it back to life. This became very evident to me in a situation in which I was reading about Ugandan history. And the more I did that, I gave these voices a certain value. I would read about the different voices. For example, this and that tribe has this and that story. He was from Bantu or region. Yes, of course, he would think that Idi Amin would be positive. But I've understood that he couldn't trust that information after understanding the background. The history repeats itself over and over again as a monster with its tentacles. And this is not good for us. They're not intending any good. And this is the reason out of which my dad packed his suitcase. And this is the reason why my dad killed his neighbor in Yugoslavia. These are things coming together. This aspect in particular brought me on this track and took me to the science fiction horror figure. But my publisher thought, well, you're able to well understand the book without the tentacled monster you describe. So this was a very moving conversation. Thanks a lot for giving us these deep insights into the traceless art of the translator. Paul, thanks for the work of the jury. Thanks, Johannes. And we will continue in a couple of minutes with the prize award. I think this is in half an hour's time, as soon as all books we've presented during the course of the afternoon have been discussed. I think all the novels would have deserved the prize, and it's now up to you to buy all of them, to buy a copy of all of them, so you've got good reading materials for a long time. Thanks a lot.